Welcome to the reading of the Quad Cities Times for today, Monday, the 15th of April, 2024. All material heard on Iris is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Carol Lockard and Jeff Cassett. Here's Carol with our first story.
Thank you, Jeff. And from the front page, Rivermont celebrates 140 years. Rivermont Collegiate is gearing up to celebrate its 140th anniversary, and in doing so, reflecting on a unique, rich history in the Quad Cities while eyeing future initiatives. Bettendorf Mayor Robert Gallagher declared on September 24th, 2024. Bettendorf Mayor Robert Gallagher declared September 24th, 2024, as Rivermont Collegiate Day, during a special ceremony on March 29th, during which he also presented Rivermont Headmaster Max Roach with a key to the city. Roach said, "Of course, it was thrilling and I was honored, but I also felt a sense of humility in light of 140 years. The truth is, I'm a temporary steward of this institution." 140 years of Quad City history. Founded in 1884, Rivermont Collegiate was initially St. Catherine's School, an Episcopal boarding and day school for girls in Davenport. In 1968, St. Catherine's became a co-educational school, adding St. Mark's to its name, and dropped its boarding program. St. Catherine's St. Mark's, also known as SKSM, moved to Rivermont's present location, the former home of Joseph W. Bettendorf, in 1973. His granddaughter, Jane Veith, was also at Rivermont's 140th anniversary and is a class of 1950 graduate. 7 years after the move, SKSM amicably broke ties with the Episcopal Church. The former Board of Trustees voted to rename the school to Rivermont College just after the turn of the century in 2001. Rivermont reintroduced its boarding program in 2017, seeking to expand its reach to domestic and international students and offer a more comprehensive, inclusive educational experience. The festivities planned for Rivermont's annual anniversary year will include events and activities to bring together alumni, current students, faculty, staff, and community members to celebrate its remarkable journey over the past 140 years. Looking forward, a look toward Rivermont's future. Moving forward, he looks to expand and enhance Rivermont, a non-sectarian preparatory school, in three areas: global footprint, sustainability, and enrollment. The school's international student pool hails from France, Spain, Germany, Serbia, Montenegro, Turkey, Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, China, Vietnam, Japan, Morocco, and other countries. As previously reported, Rivermont embarked on a dual degree agreement with the Yonggu School in Hangzhou, China, this school year, alongside talks to launch partner schools in South Korea and Monaco. Using momentum from a gushing 7-year accreditation review, Roach said Rivermont is headed into a new strategic planning cycle where the school's short and medium-term future will shake out. "We just received the best accreditation review we've received in almost 30 years. I think the message is loud and clear. We're focused on the right things," Roach said, pointing to pedagogy, curriculum, and teachers specifically. Another highlight, he said, is that Rivermont expects to retain 100% of its faculty next school year. He said, "Our strategic plan will be a comprehensive effort with input from teachers, families, both past and present, the Board of Trustees, and Bettendorf City officials. Scheduling is one area Rivermont plans to explore in its next strategic planning cycle," he said. The strategic planning also circles back to Rivermont's goal of enhancing its global appeal. As Roach said, the school is looking into adding an international baccalaureate program for 11th and 12th grade students. That program would give our graduates a huge leg up into more selective colleges and universities, Roach said. If Rivermont were to adopt this program, it would allow the school to make another strategic scheduling change, expanding AP, which is advanced placement courses, down to underclassmen. Roach said, "We're the number one school on the Iowa AP index, so we feel like some of our younger kids should be engaging in that." Rivermont will also explore shifting to a year-round school model, he said, which could be easier on international boarding students' travels and mitigate summer learning loss. Aside from programming, Roach said, another focus moving forward will be increasing Rivermont's outreach with St. Catherine St. Mark's alumni, notably renaming a portion of the Joseph Bettendorf Mansion to St. Catherine's Hall via capital campaign funds. He hopes that will better help the public see Rivermont's connection to its history. Roach said, to make sure that people really see us as an extension of that school, there is just such a great kind of social connectivity with the school and the community, and we want to highlight that. Shifting to new facilities, Rivermont began constructing its STEAM, which stands for STEAM, which stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math Center in 2019, a project now near completion. What is left are expansions to the STEAM Center's dormitory and faculty housing, which Roach said will allow Rivermont to house more students and staff on campus. He added, "We feel strongly that local kids benefit from the fundamentally unique experience of having friends from Japan, Korea, Thailand, etc. What a unique educational opportunity it is to go to a school with such rich diversity and cultivate global students here in Iowa." Roach said the school also hopes to up its sustainability efforts, noting COVID-era enrollment drops for students previously on financial aid. After rebuilding enrollment, step two would be to rebuild Rivermont's endowment, some of which had to be spent in order to survive the pandemic, he said. We can make changes comparatively quicker to most educational systems, and I think that reflective process and ability to adapt and change quickly is a huge part of our system, Roach said. I think this is a really exciting time to be at Rivermont. Jeff?
St. Ambrose dedicates Higgins Hall. It's named after 1967 graduate Thomas Higgins. For several years after Sister Joan Lisinski became president of St. Ambrose University in 2007, alumnus Thomas Higgins wanted to know how he could give back to the school that gave him the foundation for his success as a public servant and entrepreneur. He and I started talking in about 2010 or 2011, Lisinski said, as she attended the dedication of the newly remodeled and renamed Higgins Hall. The building was formerly LeClaire Hall, which was the old gymnasium with the swimming pool in the basement. A lot of things were happening, she said. The person-centered care facility was really his joy, but the building issue kept coming back and coming back. It got to the point where whenever Higgins would ask what he could do, Lisinski would respond, "LeClaire Hall, LeClaire Hall." Lisinski retired in 2021, but the move to remodel the old gymnasium had been made. Originally dedicated in 1917, LeClaire Hall's $8 million transformation from a storehouse into Higgins Hall, a state-of-the-art home to the College of Social Work, the Institute for Person-Centered Care, and the Master of Public Health program, was finalized Saturday with an invitation-only dedication and blessing ceremony attended by more than 100 people. Higgins, a 1967 graduate of St. Ambrose, wore a lot of hats to get to where he is today. He's a former writer for the Times-Democrat, a former Iowa State House representative, and served as Deputy Secretary of the Cabinet under President Jimmy Carter. He also served as a senior vice president with the insurance and electricity companies in Maryland and California before pursuing entrepreneurial opportunities, including being the founding chief executive of the San Francisco-based Procetta Biosciences. Higgins Hall now features 5 modern classrooms, social work learning spaces, and more than 20 offices. But the designers and builders kept many of the original features of the building, including the basketball court and the bank of swimming pool of the swimming pool, where on the concrete are signs that read "No Diving" and "Deep Water." Higgins said he remembered the building as a hub of activity when he was a student, and he wanted it to remain a hub of activity and learning. When he finally decided to put up the money for the renovation, he said, "I was thinking at that time this building should be at the heart of the campus. I thought it's a shame to have this asset be used for storage." He added, "We needed to make it a statement building, and we came to an agreement." Higgins said it took a lot of work to get the old building renovated, and there were a few adventures along the way. When they were punching the hole for the elevator, they found a vault where there were these big storage units from the 1940s, where they stored the fuel oil for the campus heating plant, Higgins said. Everybody had forgotten about them. The tanks still had fuel oil in them, and they had to be pumped out. It was not a small amount. Of course, he said there was asbestos abatement to be done. At one point during World War II, a lot of the buildings were taken over for the war effort, and there was a rifle range in the basement, Higgins said. During his time at St. Ambrose, Higgins said he spent a lot of time in the old LeClaire Hall. "I did not excel at any sports there, but it was a cool place to hang out," he said. Ellen Shipley of Bettendorf, one of the first women to enroll in St. Ambrose after it was converted to a coeducational university, gives architectural tours of Davenport's downtown and was pleased with what had been done to the old gymnasium, the second oldest building on campus. "My experience in this building was I had swim lessons in the middle of the day, so in the winter my hair would freeze," Shipley said. "I have a memory of the swimming pool, and it was cold and dark and dank down there," she said. "I was a cheerleader, the first cheerleader at St. Ambrose, so I may have watched a basketball game in here." Shapley, who graduated in 1972, said that as an architecture buff, "I've been impressed with what they did with the building. They kept the brickwork. They kept a lot of the original features. They kept the basketball floor, so it gives you all that history of the building. They kept a lot of the features which make this building special." The Reverend George McDaniel, who graduated from St. Ambrose Seminary in 1966 and returned to the school in 1974 as Dean of Students, said he can still see the old building in the renovation. "The changes are huge physically, obviously, but I can still see the old building because it's here as well," McDaniel said. "I didn't take PE classes here, but I ran up and down the gym floor pretending I knew how to shoot baskets. On Fridays, as seminarians, we had the use of the gym," he said. "It's wonderful to be able to reuse an old building in such an important way." Looking at the track that overlooked the basketball court, the curve is heavily banked. McDaniel said that when Leo Kilfoy was coach, he'd make the players run 6 laps one way and then 6 laps the other way, because the track is so banked, if you go to the other end in the classroom, the other curve is still there. McDaniel's favorite photo was taken in the old gym as a 1920 basketball game. Most of the men have neckties and hats on, he said. We were playing Augustana College, and I think we beat them. Former Davenport Mayor Bill Gluba, who served as an Iowa State Senator at the time Higgins was a State House representative, praised his longtime friend. Quote, ever since he was a student, he's been a fighter and a leader in the struggle for social and economic justice, Gluba said of Higgins. By his major financial contribution to this university, he wants that philosophy of fairness and justice and decency to be carried into the future. Carol?
And Quad City Times, Bic 7, it changed people's lives. About 680K of people have crossed the BX finish line. Ed Froelich is making a comeback, and he'd like to see several thousand old friends do the same. In truth, the legendary former director of the Quad City Times BX 7 never completely detached himself from the event he built into one of the largest and most respected road races in the country. After turning the director duties over to Michelle Jury in 2019, he remained involved as a member of the BIC 7's board of directors. But with the 50th annual BIC 7 looming this summer, he has stepped up his involvement. He has joined Jury and former Times publisher Deb Anselm to form a three-person advisory committee to make BIC's number 50 more special than any of the previous 49. Froelich said, I never left. You can't have a passion for something like this and give it up. But this is a much more active role. I wanted to do it. The 50th annual BIC, scheduled for July 27th, will have many more sponsors than ever before. 39, to be exact. And it includes pretty much an entire week of activities leading up to the iconic race. But the biggest addition, the one closest to Froelich's heart, is the development of the Senior BIC 7, a special race for people aged 50 and over to be held on the evening of Tuesday, July 23rd. It will be a relatively short race, only a mile and a half, that runs along the Mississippi River, starting in the LeClaire Park, going down to Marquette Street and back. Unlike the main BIC race, which begins with a charge up the daunting Brady Street Hill and includes very little level ground, the Senior BICs will be completely flat. Almost anyone of any age should be able to walk at least part of the course. I know there are people my age and even 10 years younger. They can't go up Brady anymore, said the 77-year-old Froelich, but this is a flat, easy course right along the Mississippi River. Entry in the Senior BICs entitles those runners and walkers to also come back to do the traditional BIC 7 or the 2-mile quick BICs on Saturday morning. Or, as Juring pointed out, they can simply do their own virtual BICs on a course of their own choosing. The potential is there for them to receive two t-shirts and a souvenir medal, all for the price of entering one race. Froelich thinks the entrants in the Senior BICs also could get something less tangible out of their participation. He sees this as a victory lap for those who ambled up and down the hills of the BICs in their younger years. He said, I want them to remember the pride they had, how proud they were of themselves when they completed the BICs. It changed people's lives. He mentions people like Val Sevtich, who lost a leg in a hiking accident at Maquoketa Cave State Park and came back to do the BICs on crutches less than a year later. There are hundreds of similar tales of people who used the race as a way to overcome obstacles in their lives or relied on it as a reason to become more physically fit. For a half century, the race has been a way for people to connect to their community and celebrate it. It's been so much more than just a world-class road race and Froelich figures. The Senior BICs is a way for past participants to reconnect and jog those old memories. There are just so many things that are so inspiring about the race, he added. You find that when you do something that is that hard and you complete it, you have a sense of pride. I want them to remember it and to do it one more time. Froelich said close to 680,000 people have crossed the finish line in the BICs over those previous 49 years. He added that the race also regularly has involved about 5,000 volunteers. All these wonderful people over all these years, that's what has blessed the Big Seven with such international fame, he said. What I'd like to say to every one of them is this. If you can still join in any way, this is the year to do it. Come back. This is the golden year to join in again. Jering says she sees the Senior Bix as a way to pay tribute to all those who have made the race great simply by participating. She said, I call it the generation that has brought the Bix to where we are right now. We probably would not have had the Bix as it is now without them. So, let's do something to honor them. Jeff?
That's a great event. Here's a news tracker column. Housing for traveling nurses being built. What we know, it can be difficult to find housing in Geneseo. What's new? Geneseo aldermen on Tuesday approved a conditional use permit for Hammond Henry Hospital to build a 76 by 40 foot hospital accessory building for two small apartments for residential housing for traveling nurses or doctors who can't find housing in Geneseo. The building would be on two lots on Melvin Lane, just north of the main campus parking lot at the hospital. Building inspector Rick Mills said the apartments will not be rented out and would be strictly for hospital use only. What's next? Giving a member services update to the council, Brian Schmid, Geneseo's liaison with the Bi-State Regional Commission, mentioned high-speed passenger rail being one of the organization's legislative priorities. The ball isn't in our court, but we're trying to make enough noise to where it'll start rolling again, he said. He said with the Illinois Department of Transportation in negotiations, the department can't share a lot with Bi-State. We don't have enough information to bring the long-range plan, he said. The problem, he said, is that the Iowa Interstate Railroad is asking for an amount of money that is higher than the IDOT says it will cost. It doesn't seem like either side is going to move on the issue, said Mayor Sean Johnson. Schmid said it's possible to bring in national arbitrators, terming that the very rare step to take, but he added the issue has been in negotiation for 10 years. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And a man facing arson, stalking charges. Authorities have charged a man on allegations he set a building on fire and committed several acts of vandalism in early April. Garrett Condon, 26 years old, address unavailable, faces charges of arson, stalking, and several counts of criminal mischief, according to court records. The charges stem from Condon's alleged acts during three different incidences on April 7th. The charges have been filed in three separate cases. The house fire. Just after 1 a.m., the Davenport Fire Department rescued a woman and a dog from a burning home in the 1200 block of West Locust Street. In court documents filed on April 9th, authorities allege Condon set that fire. The woman was sleeping upstairs and had to be rescued from the second-story balcony because of smoke and fire conditions. Firefighters found a dead cat in the residence, but the court records did not detail how it died. Further investigation found the fire, which was in the basement, had been intentionally set, records state. While on scene, investigators found spray paint on three vehicles, records state. They also found an above-ground pool with a lacerated liner that caused it to leak. Overall, the damage was estimated to be more than $10,000. Condon faces charges of first-degree arson and first-degree criminal mischief in relation to the fire and vandalism at the Locust address, records state. Second item, smashed windshield. At about 7:30 p.m. on April 7th, court records allege, Condon jumped on the hood of an occupied vehicle at the Davenport Skate Park at 900 West River Drive. He kicked the windshield, breaking it. The driver was the same woman rescued from the fire, records state. The damage to the car was estimated to be between $300 and $750, records state. Condon faces a count of fourth-degree criminal mischief for his alleged role in this instance, records state. And the next and third item, bricks. Police canvassing in the 1200 block of West 17th Street for camera footage of the arson found graffiti like that at the Locust Street residence. The officers found it on a home. At about 9:39 p.m., Condon threw two landscaping bricks through two windows at the same residence, authorities allege in court records. The bricks broke the windows and a television. Authorities estimated the damage as more than $1,500, but less than $10,000. The person listed in the court records as the victim in this case was not the same woman listed in the other two. In relation to this incident, Condon faces the stalking charge and a charge of second-degree criminal mischief, according to court records. Arrest and court. On April 10th, the courts approved warrants for Condon's arrest in relation to the three incidents. The Davenport Police Department served them on Saturday and brought Condon to the Scott County Jail at 2 p.m. He remained in custody on Sunday, held on a $51,000 bond, cash-only bond, according to the jail website. Condon has had his initial appearance in all three cases, according to court records. His next hearing has been set for April 23rd. Jeff?
Quad City Reps Proposed Grant Program. Proposed bill would offer grants for site development. Communities could apply for several grants to make sites shovel-ready for manufacturing facilities under a bill introduced by two Quad Cities congressional representatives, U.S. Representatives Marionette Miller-Meeks and Eric Sorensen of Illinois, introduced the bill called the Opportunities for Non-Developed Sites to Have Opportunities to Be Rehabilitated for Economic Development. Abbreviated as Onshore Act, to strengthen supply chains by helping communities attract manufacturing companies, jobs, and facilities, the officials said. The bill would appropriate $100 million annually for fiscal years 2024 through 2028. The money would go to grants to communities to carry out site development or expansion projects to ready sites for manufacturing facilities in strategically important industries, a Friday press release stated. We have turned down dozens of requests for information related to projects that could bring thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in investment to the Illinois-Iowa Quad Cities due to a lack of available shovel-ready land and move-in-ready buildings, said Ryan Semph, Executive Director of Government Affairs for the Quad City Chamber of Commerce, in the release. Onshore will help the Quad Cities and other communities compete for these projects while supporting American interests in the reshoring of critical supply chain industries. From 2021 to 2023, the Illinois side of the Quad Cities could not reply to companies looking to bring in jobs 75 times, according to Sorensen's office. Out of these, 60 inquiries were about manufacturing projects that could have created thousands of jobs. Manufacturing is the heartbeat of what keeps our economy strong and our communities thriving, Sorensen said. The Onshore Act provides opportunities for our towns, cities, and villages to create sustainable jobs for generations to come. The grant program would be managed by the U.S. Department of Commerce, and the Secretary of Commerce would decide which industries are strategically important and eligible for the grants. The grants could cover expenses such as connecting the site to public utilities, water mains or sewers, for example, completing environmental reviews required by the National Environmental Policy Act, and investing in training programs for local workforce. By establishing the Critical Supply Chain Site Development Grant Program, we're investing in the revitalization of communities, fostering economic growth, and fortifying our domestic supply chains, Miller Meeks said. This program not only empowers regions to attract investment and create jobs in Iowa, but also ensures our nation's strategic interests and economic security are safeguarded. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And now we'll move to the obituaries. There were no obituaries today, but we have a whole slug of them from yesterday. So we may edit them a little bit to save time. First one is for Patrick Shale Cleese, age 86, resident of Long Lake, Minnesota, passed away at home on April 8, 2024. He was preceded in death by his parents, Louis and Frances Wombold Cleese, twin sisters Kay McGee, sister Carolyn Chamber, and brother Gary Cleese. Patrick was born January 7, 1938, in Forest City, Iowa, and raised in Bettendorf, Iowa. He graduated from St. Ambrose Academy in Davenport, Iowa, and moved to Minneapolis, where he began his 50-plus career in the consumer electronics industry. In Minneapolis, he met the love of his life, Lois Ozen. He and Lois were united in marriage on June 20, 1964, at Mount Olivet Lutheran Church in Minneapolis. Patrick and Lois remain lifelong members of Mount Olivet. Singing for several years in the Mount Olivet Choir was a delight to Patrick. Over their 59 years together, Lois and Patrick had travel adventures to Japan, Hawaii, Florida, France, England, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. His funeral service will be on Friday, April 9th, 2024, at 2 p.m. at David Lee Funeral Home at 1220 East Wayzata Boulevard, Wayzata, Minnesota, 55391. Visitation begins 1 hour prior to the service. Interment will be at Lakewood Cemetery in Minneapolis on Saturday, April 20th, 2024, at noon for family members. Memorials may be directed to Mount Olivet Lutheran Church at 5025 Knox Avenue South, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55419, or the American Heart Association at www.heart.org. Jeff?
Ellis O. Barber, age 98, of DeWitt, passed away Friday afternoon, April 5th, at Fieldstone DeWitt. Memorial services will be held Saturday, April 20th, at 11 a.m. at the First Congregational United Church of Christ in DeWitt. Visitation will be at 10 a.m. until service time at the church. Burial will take place in the Elmwood Cemetery, DeWitt, with a luncheon to follow at the church. Ellis Orville Barber was born April 18, 1925, at the family farm north of DeWitt. He was the fifth of seven children and the fifth son born to Elsie Maynard Barber and Freeland E. Barber. He attended a one-room country school through the eighth grade and graduated from DeWitt High School in 1942. After high school, he farmed in partnership with his father. In 1958, he moved to DeWitt and started an insurance and real estate business. In 1965, Ellis joined DeWitt Bank and Trust Company and was president when he retired in 1987. Ellis married Myrtle Elizabeth Thomas on October 9, 1946, and three children were born to them, William Ellis, Dean Richard, and Jeanette Marie. They loved ballroom dancing and enjoyed traveling the world, visiting six continents. In retirement, they spent 30 winters in Mesa, Arizona, where Ellis was active in the Electronics Club and enjoyed social activities. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the First Congregational United Church of Christ in DeWitt or to the Shriners Hospital for Children. The Clinton Snell Zoring Funeral Homes and Crematory is assisting the family with arrangements.
And from DeWitt, Ellis O. Barber, 98. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. You just heard that from Jeff. Voya Moon, 83, passed away peacefully on April 11th, 2024. Voya was born in Belgrade, Serbia. She grew up in a war-torn country, hiding in bomb shelters as a young child during World War II. At 17 years old, she traveled alone by boat to America, where she finished her senior year of high school. She then went on to graduate from Northern Arizona University with a degree in chemistry. She met her husband, John Harold Moon, during her time as a student. They married in 1961 and had their only child, John Dedalus J.D. Moon. Aside from her family, education was Voya's greatest passion. She worked as a teacher at the high school level and taught chemistry and math courses in a local community college. Throughout her years as an educator, she gave her time freely to students, often acting as a tutor and mentor. Voya never stopped learning, earning a master's degree, plus 30 hours of additional education in chemistry. Voya was preceded in death by her husband, John. She is survived by her son, J.D., and her grandchildren, Vanessa, Jared, and Eric, whom she loved dearly. Memorials in Voya's name may be made to the Davenport Public Library or to the APRIS program offered by WVIK Radio.
James L. Jim Coucher, age 78, of Bluegrass, died Wednesday, April 10th at Genesis East in Davenport. Private family services will take place with burial in Oakview Cemetery in Welton, Iowa. Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home assisted the family with arrangements. Memorials may be made to the Bluegrass Fire Department. James Lewis Coucher was born on May 24, 1945, in the family home in Buffalo, a son of George F. and Minnie Boyer Coucher. He graduated from Bettendorf High School in 1963. Jim was united in marriage to Virginia Ginger Bolt on August 7, 1965 at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Davenport. She preceded him in death on June 24, 2018, following 52 years of marriage. Jim retired from Ralston Purina following 37 years of service. He later worked for Salzman International. The Coucher family would like to thank the Bluegrass Fire Department for all they've done for Jim. Online condolences may be expressed by visiting hmdfuneralhome.com.
And from Venice, Florida, James W., known as Jim Fitzpatrick, 90 years old, passed away peacefully at home on March 19, 2024, in Venice, Florida. He was born July 21, 1933, in Cherokee, Iowa, to Maurice and Nora Fitzpatrick, and died after a brief illness. A memorial service will be held on April 18, 2024, at 10 a.m. at Epiphany Catholic Church in Venice. A celebration of life will follow at Made in Italy, Venice, Florida, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Jim spent his younger days in Storm Lake, Iowa, where he graduated from St. Mary's High School and Buena Vista University, received his master's degree in music composition from Drake University in Des Moines. He spent many years as a music teacher, then worked as a federal computer programmer at the Rock Island Arsenal in Rock Island, Illinois, before retiring to Florida. He supported a wide range variety of charities throughout his life. In lieu of flowers, please donate to the St. Francis Animal Rescue of Venice or the Senior Friendship Center of Venice. Jim was a true gentleman and scholar. One of his friends put it best, what this old world sorely needs now is more Jim Fitzpatrick's.
Mary Patricia Pat Mullins, age 91, of Atlanta, Georgia, and Davenport, passed away Sunday, April 7th, surrounded by her family. Pat was smart, loving, and kind, with an affinity for children and animals. Her greatest joy was time with her daughters, and she devoted herself to their well-being, personal growth, and accomplishment. She was born September 9th, 1932, and grew up traveling the Midwest with her parents following the oil boom of the 1930s and 40s. Pat became a physical therapist, graduating from the University of Michigan with a master's degree in kinesiology. Her early career included serving in community health clinics during the polio epidemic in Detroit and Cleveland. She taught at Marquette University in Milwaukee, where she met and married Jim Mullins and began a family. The couple moved to Davenport in the 1970s, where Pat served on the Mississippi Bend AEA, where she pioneered physical therapy in the schools in Davenport, including at Truman Elementary, serving disabled youth before the years of mainstreamed special education. In accordance with her wishes and preference toward simplicity, there will be no services. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to charities that honor her passions: the Southern Poverty Law Center, the American Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, ASPCA.
From Davenport, Mary Elizabeth Buzik. Funeral services and mass of Christian burial for Mary Buzik, 75, of Davenport, will be held at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, April 16th, 2024, at St. Anthony's Catholic Church in Davenport. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery. Mount Calvary Cemetery in Davenport. Visitation will be from 9 a.m. until time of services on Tuesday at the church. Memorials may be made to the McAnthony Window. Ms. Buzik passed away Thursday, April 4th, 2024, at her home, Halligan McCabe DeVry Funeral Home in Davenport, is assisting with arrangements. Mary Elizabeth Buzik was born April 18th, 1948, in Terre Haute, Indiana, the daughter of Joseph and Ann Cotta Buzik. Prior to her retirement, she wore many hats for the IITI group, which included accounting and IT. In her early years, she had worked for Columbia Records and briefly as a math teacher. She was an active member at the St. Mary Catholic Church in Davenport until it closed. She was a Eucharistic minister, altar server, teacher, Salvation Army worker, visiting homebound, playing the piano, enjoying listening to the choir. She was master gardener, a member of Women's Construction, and the Iowa Association of Railroad Passengers. Online remembrances may be expressed at www.hmdfuneralhome.com.
And finally, Brian Michael Grell, age 57, of Davenport, passed away Wednesday, April 10th. Funeral services will be held on Friday, April 19th, at 6 p.m. at Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home. Visitation will be held from 4 p.m. until the time of service at the funeral home. A celebration of life will be immediately following at the Circle Tap. Memorials may be made to the family for the grandchildren. Brian was born June 8, 1966, in Clinton, son of Harold and Sandra Madsen Grell. He was united in marriage to Sherry on October 5, 1996. He worked at Alcoa Arconic for 34 years. He found joy in spending time with those he loved. His sense of humor was never-ending. Always had a smile on his face, particularly when the Vikings were beating the Packers or Bears, or the Cardinals were beating the Cubs. His generosity was endless. We hope they have Harleys in heaven. B. He was preceded in death by his parents. Online tributes may be expressed at www.hmdfuneralhome.com. funeralhome.com. Time for opinions. Here's Carol.
Thank you, Jeff. It's appropriate today that we have these articles entitled, IRS Can Do Your Taxes. Since it is April 15th, filing directly will save time and money. The author of this is Gene Ross, Senior Fellow for Economic Policy at the Center for American Progress. Everyone should pay the taxes they owe without having to pay for the privilege of doing so. This year, for the first time, residents of 12 states who file simple tax returns can file online for free using the IRS's new direct file portal. Thanks to funding from the Inflation Reduction Act and as part of the ambitious modernization effort, this new public tool makes tax filing faster, easier, and cheaper for eligible filers. The IRS wisely started small, piloting direct file in four states, Arizona, California, Massachusetts, and New York. Each state agreed to implement an integrated option for filing a state tax return. Eight other states, Florida, Nevada, New Hampshire, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Washington, and Wyoming, are eligible for direct file without such an option for filing a state return. Similarly, eligibility for direct file is limited to filers with certain types of income who do not itemize their deductions. People with wage and salary income from an employer, Social Security benefits, modest interest income, and unemployment insurance. Importantly, direct file can be used to claim the child and earned income tax credits, providing valuable support to millions of working families. Helping families claim these credits by eliminating the cost of tax filing may be one of direct file's most important contributions. In 2020, the most recent year for which data is available, nearly one out of four individuals eligible for the earned income tax credit did not claim the credit they were owed. Filers can prepare their returns on a smartphone, tablet, or desktop, and online support is available weekdays and evenings in Spanish and English from a live IRS professional, not an AI-powered chatbot. Early reviews of direct file show strong support, with users reporting it as the fastest I've ever done my taxes and honestly the easiest tax experience I have ever had. The enthusiastic response to a free online filing option should not be surprising. The typical taxpayer spends 13 hours and $270 each year preparing a federal tax return, according to the IRS. Money saved by filing for free is money back in families' pockets. Direct file is arguably a long overdue solution. The tax preparation software industry lobbied hard to block previous bipartisan public portal efforts dating back to the late 1990s. The industry suppressed participation in its privately managed alternative, according to ProPublica, resulting in just 3% of filers using the industry-backed program in 2020, in contrast to the estimated 70% of filers eligible to do so. Private firms also used hardball tactics to upsell consumers, leading state attorneys general to secure a large settlement with TurboTax's owner for deceptive advertising. Direct file is a choice. Individuals who prefer to buy private software or use an accountant are welcome to do so, but the success of this year's pilot suggests direct file will be used by most Americans with relatively simple tax situations. To scale the pilot to more tax filers in more states, the IRS must work quickly with state tax administrators to ensure that filers who wish to use a public option can seamlessly file their federal and state tax returns. It will also require sustained support and the funding needed to reverse a decade of disinvestment and rebuild the IRS to improve customer service and ensure the nation's tax laws are enforced effectively. In the meantime, if you qualify for the direct file pilot and have yet to complete your tax return, you should check it out. If you've finished your taxes, give yourself a well-deserved pat on the back. For all of us, filed or yet to file, the new direct file tool represents government at its best. That's something to cheer about. Happy Tax Day.
The second opinion piece is entitled Don't Trust Agency with More Power. It's written by David B. McGarry, who is a policy analyst at the Taxpayers Protection Alliance. He writes, Tax Day is a certainty, as Ben Franklin said. This year, the Internal Revenue Service has launched a pilot program dubbed Direct File, so Americans can opt to have the IRS prepare their taxes for free. Well, except for the billions of taxpayer dollars used to create the program. The IRS wants to eliminate Americans' reliance on tax preparation services in the private sector. Despite its recent trendiness in certain circles, Direct File has little potential for good and much for bad. In addition to the pilot program's dubious legality, the public has many fiscal reasons not to trust the IRS with this new responsibility. Adding a federally operated competitor to a market does not equate to providing or promoting competition, as some of its advocates have argued. Nobody would consider creating a federal grocery store, a federal airline, or a federal movie studio as a pro-market policy. State-run enterprises are not subject to the ordinary competitive pressures to which private businesses must remain sensitive and respond. Neither does a direct file system seem likely to provide a valuable service to taxpayers. The proposed system's very conceit clangs against the American legal and political tradition in which adversarial actors help guard liberty and good governance. This combative friction, the defense lawyer against the prosecution, Congress against the presidency, the states against the federal government, ensures, in theory at least, that no one faction or institution has a smooth route to self-interested injustice. The IRS proposes to excise such friction. The agency wants to file the citizens' taxes, collect that money, and double back to conduct audits, without any mediating institution to stop potential, if not likely, abuse. Washington politicians and bureaucrats should not promote its adoption. Low-income and minority taxpayers, whom IRS auditors target disproportionately and whom the IRS would likely market direct file most energetically, have perhaps the most significant interest in retaining private intermediaries such as TurboTax or TaxSlayer. What's more, direct file would not be free. Americans might not pay when filing their taxes, but those tax dollars would fund the digital infrastructure, personnel, and other resources undergirding the system. The IRS estimates direct file would cost $64 million to $249 million annually, which seems wildly low. The Obamacare website cost taxpayers $20 billion through October 2021. An audit by the Treasury Inspector General for the Tax Administration could not confirm the IRS's cost assumptions, nor could the agency meaningfully defend them. When we asked the IRS for documentation supporting how it arrived at these various cost estimates, the Inspector General said it could not provide us with any. The proper remedy to any issues with private tax preparation companies is to address discrete problems where they exist. Instead, advocates of direct file propose to centralize still more power in one of Washington's least responsible agencies, injecting a fully socialized competitor into the market and mucking up the basic principles of American governance. Carol, it seems that we've run out of time for the sports section, so let's just close with the with the close. That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been the wonderful Carol Lockhart. You can listen to IRS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.